you know, what's interesting is if you look at the obituaries, which I, unfortunately, I read, you know, dozens of these a day, almost all of them say that the memorial service will happen at a later date, right? It's just because people don't want to accept that they're done with the mourning process with four or five people at a graveside funeral, and they don't want to do it on Zoom. They want to be able to bring people together. And so I think it'll be interesting to see how that manifests in, you know, a year or so from now.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Culturally Relevant, a podcast about film, television, art, and culture. I'm David Chen, and today I'm going to be speaking with Alex Goldstein, who created the Twitter account Faces of COVID, which I will tell you about in just a little bit. But before that, a few announcements, a few reflections on what's going on in the world right now. First of all, I want to say, as always, this podcast is brought to you because of the generosity of folks over at patreon.com/Dave Chen. That's patreon.com/Dave Chen. I'm able to do this podcast because folks over there are helping me to fund it. In particular, I want to thank all of my executive producers this month: Steve Austin, Christopher Yimon, Dan Flanagan, Jeff Evans, Mark C. Warner, and Sid Yadav. Thank you so much for your donations. And if you want to support this podcast, support what I do over here at Culturally Relevant, head on over to patreon.com/Dave Chen. Super grateful for everyone who has done the same. If you want to support this podcast without paying any money at all, there's a very easy way to do that. You can follow this podcast on Twitter at CrevShow, CrevShow, or leave a star rating or review at Apple Podcasts. It really just takes a few seconds and it makes a huge difference. So I'd encourage you to do that if you are enjoying listening to the podcast. All right. On with some recent thoughts. I had Thanksgiving last week in a little COVID bubble. It's me, my wife, and our friend Carter. And we had a great time. And we also made a little video about how we made our COVID bubble. That's up on YouTube. I'll link to that in the show notes. But the three of us basically see each other every day and no one else. So we are battening down the hatches in preparation for what we anticipate is going to be a really challenging December and January time period, in which many people are flouting the rules, are flouting guidelines, and are not doing everything they can to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. According to the New York Times, on December 3rd, there were 216,000 cases of coronavirus and 2,857 new coronavirus deaths, which is close to how many people died on 9/11. So we're now absorbing a 9/11's worth of deaths every single day. And the tragedy is on a scale that's unimaginable. I read this article at theatlantic.com entitled, "Iowa is What Happens When Government Does Nothing. The story of the coronavirus in the state is one of government inaction in the name of freedom and personal responsibility." And the article essentially details how Iowa is having a really tough go of it because this is a state that has essentially done nothing at all to stem the flood of coronavirus cases. No useful guidance, no useful example setting. Just let the virus rage on undeterred. And we are seeing the result of that. According to the article, quote, "By late November, the number of new COVID-19 cases in Iowa was higher than at any other point in the pandemic, and as many as 45 Iowans were dying of the disease every 24 hours in a state of just 3 million people. Outbreaks were reported in 156 nursing homes and assisted living facilities in Iowa, and the virus ran rampant in the state's prisons. Doctors have been warning for weeks that the state's healthcare system is close to its breaking point. The University of Iowa hospital reached a peak of 37 COVID-19 inpatients in April, but by Thanksgiving it had 90. That number may not seem overwhelming until you consider that COVID-19 patients require dozens of staff and that many spend weeks or months in hospital care. To meet the demand, administrators have had to reschedule hundreds of non-essential surgeries and converted multiple wards into COVID-19 units. Doctors told me they're already short on ICU beds and are having to decide which critically ill patients receive one," end quote. What the article goes on to say and conclude is how unnecessary the suffering and death is, you know, and there are so many people, not just politicians, but also regular citizens, who have taken the coronavirus as an opportunity to play politics, to use it as a component of the culture war. And it just is so sad and unnecessary. You know, it doesn't need to be this way. If we all act selflessly or as selflessly as we can, if we all try to respect science, then deaths can be prevented. And I think it's cliche to say, but basically, the pandemic has revealed deeper sicknesses within the American psyche. I was reading this op-ed that the Pope wrote, the Pope, for the New York Times. And the op-ed is entitled, "A Crisis Reveals What Is in Our Hearts." And he writes here, quote, "With some exceptions, governments have made great efforts to put the well-being of their people first, acting decisively to protect health and to save lives. The exceptions have been some governments that shrugged off the painful evidence of mounting deaths with inevitable grievous consequences. But most governments acted responsibly, imposing strict measures to contain the outbreak. Yet some groups protested, refusing to keep their distance, marching against travel restrictions, as if measures that governments must impose for the good of their people constitute some kind of political assault on autonomy or personal freedom. Looking to the common good is much more than the sum of what is good for individuals. It means having a regard for all citizens and seeking to respond effectively to the needs of the least fortunate," end quote. Pretty reasonable stuff from the Pope, Pope Francis, the head of the Catholic Church and the Bishop of Rome. Of course, there was a backlash to this. Some people think the Pope is getting too lefty. And that is just how far distorted the minds of many folks in the Republican Party, on the religious right, have become, is that the idea of advocating for the collective good on any level is now perceived as an attack on freedom. And I think that is unfortunate. It's wild that the Pope is receiving attacks from the right these days. And it shows just how far as a country we have shifted. All that in mind, I want to talk about today's guest, Alex Goldstein. So when coronavirus first started happening and the magnitude of the death started to become clear, I mean, according to the New York Times, there have been over 276,000 deaths as a result of coronavirus. But that only counts the deaths in which coronavirus was actually diagnosed. If you look at another metric called excess deaths, that is to say deaths over what we would have expected this year, the number is much higher. It's in the 300,000s. This is a toll that is really hard to wrap your mind around. It's hard to comprehend the magnitude of the suffering, the tragedy, and there was very little collective mourning going on. And there's many reasons for that. And I think part of that is because of the enormity of the task. I don't think there's an easy way to comprehend this, to even communicate this. And that's why I'm so grateful for this Twitter account, Faces of COVID, which I noticed a few months ago and has now grown to over 130,000 followers. And every day, Faces of COVID shares images and very short stories and links out to articles of people who have died of COVID, just regular, everyday Americans. I started following this account, and I was just deeply moved by the huge variety of human life that has been affected and taken by the virus. And I was so grateful that this account exists because it reminds us of what we've lost. You can say a statistic, and the statistic is really horrifying, but when you look at the Faces of COVID Twitter account, you're looking at the actual faces of people we've lost. You're hearing their stories. You're learning about their personalities. And it's reminding us that as massive of a scale as this tragedy is taking place on, it's also taking place on a micro level. You know, it's grandfathers and mothers and sisters that we've lost. And I'm grateful that Faces of COVID is providing this service. So I was really fortunate that the creator of this account, Alex Goldstein, agreed to chat with me today about creating this account and what he's learned over time from managing this account, the hardest part of maintaining Faces of COVID, and how his account has exactly become super meaningful to people who have lost folks in this pandemic. Alex Goldstein is the CEO of 90 West, a strategic communications company, and the creator of Faces of COVID, a Twitter account memorializing COVID victims that now has over 130,000 followers. I hope you appreciate this conversation. It's one of the most moving conversations I've ever had on this podcast. I was deeply affected listening to Alex tell the story of how he maintains this account, and I hope you are too. So here's my conversation with Alex, and stay tuned for weekly recommendations after our interview. Alex Goldstein, thanks so much for joining me today on Culturally Relevant. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing all right. Thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
So tell us a little bit about who you are and just what you do in your daily life when you're not managing this Twitter account.
Sure. So born and raised here in Boston, Massachusetts, and really haven't left. My day job is I spent about a decade working in politics in Massachusetts. I was the spokesman for the governor of Massachusetts, the former governor, Deval Patrick, for many years. And then after my decade or so in politics and government, went into the private sector and eventually started my own company about 4 years ago. That's a strategic communications firm here in Boston, but it's really just a fancy way to say that we do storytelling and specifically focused around equity issues around the climate crisis. And so a lot of connections to the work that I'm doing at Faces of COVID. And that's really in the pandemic mode, it really is just me toggling between my day job and Faces of COVID. There's not much going on beyond that. So
tell us about what compelled you to create this account, Faces of COVID.
Sure. I think in mid-March, I found myself in a position that a lot of people were in, especially being here in the Northeast where things had escalated so quickly as they did actually also out in your neck of the woods. The first couple of weeks we were getting inundated with these headlines that were almost impossible to wrap your head around, and around the number of cases, around skyrocketing deaths. And I felt both overwhelmed by the kind of horror of the numbers, but also to some extent kind of numbed out to the human impact behind them. And as somebody who really kind of needs that emotional connection to information to understand it, beyond the data, it was important for me to find almost like my own cathartic way to process what was happening out there. And so initially I had just sort of experimented with doing some research about the people that were actually behind these numbers in the early days of the pandemic and sharing them on my personal Twitter feed. And as I saw that there was really a broader interest in this, decided it was important to make it something that folks could opt into. And that's when I sort of kicked off the formal Faces of COVID account at the end of March. And, since that time, really the primary motivation has been to, give some dignity and put a face and a name to the abstract numbers that I think at some point, I think people can connect with, but it's hard to really feel like you intimately have an understanding of exactly what's happening out there if you're not able to bear witness to who those people were. And, I think there's a secondary reason and motivation that is still really important to me, which was around accountability. I think even in the earliest days of the pandemic, it became clear that this was just a horrific mismanagement of our federal response. And as such, I think that every single story that we do share really does beg a question of us about what we could have done to prevent this, both from a government policy level, but also in community, because if you're a good member of community, you have a responsibility to take care of your neighbors. And one thing we've seen in this country, unfortunately, is that too many of us are willing to, not look after each other with devastating consequences. And so I'd say those were probably the two primary motivations for it.
It's been interesting for me to observe how we as a society have responded to COVID and specifically the grieving or mourning process. Mm-hmm. I think the most stark comparison is probably 9/11, right? When that tragedy occurred, decades later, we are still tons of airtime on TV networks and documentaries and so on and so forth around remembering these people that were lost. Like the numbers was repeated many times, like the thousands of people. And I just feel like when this thing, this coronavirus pandemic started kicking off, we didn't really have a way of mourning in public about it for a variety of reasons. One is that, like, it's been written often that the coronavirus kind of separates people, right? People aren't able to visit their loved ones in hospital rooms because of the pandemic. So that's part of it, right? But also just, it's not something that, you know, New York Times keeps track of it, your account keeps track of it, but I feel like there's not much going on a nightly basis to kind of mourn the people we've lost, which is why I find the account to be such a valuable resource. It kind of reminds us that there are faces behind these statistics, which is something I don't think we get enough these. We don't get enough of that these days, in my opinion.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think, by the way, there's real policy implications for that being missing from the public space, right? Because if you can't connect with the real faces behind these things, then you're less likely, I would argue, to take steps to protect other people and take actions that keep other people safe. And I think at the government level, I think they, you know, the pandemic response has been, you know, sort of subpar, in part because there's been no reckoning with the human toll behind this. And, you know, I had been thinking out loud the other day that I wonder if our pandemic response might have looked different if every single public official, every member of Congress, our mayors, our local legislatures all had to spend an hour a week sitting across the table from somebody in the community who had lost a loved one to COVID. But because this is such an isolating moment, I think that it's been easy for folks to pretend that this isn't going on, or to not be as forceful in their response. And that's had real consequences.
I think one of the things that I reflect on is one of my colleagues, her name is Melissa Taminga. She's been a guest on this podcast before. We were discussing why it is that the U.S. seems to be having a difficult time mourning those we've lost. And again, comparing it to 9/11, for all, despite what you want to say about the underlying causes of the violence that was done to us, it was something that was fundamentally done to us, mm-hmm. right? It was an attack on American soil, whereas COVID and the coronavirus and the pandemic and like the lives we've lost in many ways is something that the U.S. has done to itself, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I am curious, like, I wonder if that plays a part in it, that because it's something that we've done to ourselves, it's through our inaction, it's through incompetence, it's through, politicization or whatever, that like it's too painful to face this destruction because it's something that we've done to ourselves. I don't know. It's just a speculating on what might be the cause of this, in my opinion, lack of public mourning. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, but that's just a couple of musings there.
So I think that is a part of it. I think that, look, fundamentally, I don't know that we've ever been in a situation in which we've, you know, looking back at, you know, world wars and all of these other experiences this country has been through where we've had such a dramatic loss of life, but also the sort of public health necessity that we stay isolated, right? And so I think that at just the most base level, our inability to even attend a funeral of a loved one because of fear of spreading virus, the lack of memorial services and all of these things that would be the normal way that we would approach something like this is either been canceled, significantly decreased, or deferred. You know, one of the interesting things is that a year from now, there will probably be hundreds and hundreds of memorial services a week remembering people who died a year ago, provided we're in a better place that we all hope we'll be in a year. And so I wonder how much of this is being deferred as opposed to erased. Yeah. So that's an open question. But I do think you're right. I think that there's something that our frustration with our own government, our frustration with each other, does make us experience this differently. And the ways in which we sort of grieve this, you know, it's not a necessarily as much as a collective, unifying experience the way that it was after 9/11. You know, what's interesting is I was in high school. I was a senior in high school, I believe, when 9/11 happened. And I remember it truly as a formative experience in my life. I had friends who lost people who were really close to them. And, you know, I remember it as both a traumatic experience, but also something where, you know, I grew very close to many of my friends who had gone through that because we had that chance to mourn together at a really important time in our lives. I, you know, look at this moment and you have to work to bear witness here. Unless it's happened to you or it's happened to somebody that you're really close with and you've attempted a Zoom memorial or something like that. You know, what's interesting is if you look at the obituaries, which I, unfortunately, I read, you know, dozens of these a day, almost all of them say that the memorial service will happen at a later date, right? It's just because people don't want to accept that they're done with the mourning process with four or five people at a graveside funeral, and they don't want to do it on Zoom. They want to be able to bring people together. And so I think it'll be interesting to see how that manifests in, you know, a year or so from now.
So tell us a little bit about the working process for maintaining this account. You said you read obituaries. I also understand you take submissions from folks. Like, how do you figure out what your daily content calendar is like? And I know it sounds trite for me to say the words content calendar. It sounds like, you know, you're programming tweets for like Wendy's or whatever, but obviously I understand it's the situation is much more grave than that, but like fundamentally you are maintaining a content calendar. So yeah, curious how you do that.
You know, and I'll say that it's sort of evolved over time. I mean, at the outset, the stories were being sourced from two primary places, either from, you know, vetted local or national news outlets that actually confirmed someone for having died of COVID-19, or from obituaries that run in newspapers but are submitted by family members in which, you know, they self-identify as somebody who had lost someone to COVID-19. And those stories, I mean, there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them, especially sort of in that April, May, and June period that I, you know, I'm still haven't got through sort of everything that I had called during that period. And usually my process is that I sort of have a running list of all of the stories that I haven't been able to post yet. And, you know, I'm doing my best to try to do them in a somewhat chronological fashion, but also, you know, going back to stories that I may have missed that I'm surfacing throughout time. In the last 2 months, what's changed significantly is I created a submission form because we were finding that a lot of folks were submitting these stories through the direct message feature on Twitter, and it was really hard to keep track of everything because there were so many messages coming through. And so created a submission form.
It's not the Twitter direct message is not built for something like this, right?
No, where definitely not. And especially
tons of different sources and you need to sort it and stuff.
Exactly. And also because you really don't want to be inaccurate. You know, you don't want to misspell somebody's name. You don't want to accidentally post the wrong picture or, you know, get even the date of their passing wrong or their age or anything like that. And so the submission form has actually been really, really valuable because we've had over 200 submissions and it's only been up for about, you know, 4 weeks. Because I really feel an obligation and a responsibility to get to those family submitted stories as quickly as I can, most of the content right now is coming directly from submissions just because there's so many of them. Most of those submissions, interestingly enough, are really recent. And so, you know, there are people who have died in November and October. So usually I'm, you know, putting together a combination of family submitted stories and then also some that I call from news outlets. Oftentimes what you'll find in the news coverage are stories that where somebody's vocation is part of the reason that it's getting news coverage because they're a doctor or a nurse or a firefighter or an EMT. And I think those stories are important. The vocational ones are important because they are symbolic of the sort of frontline sacrifices that folks are making and who we're losing. And so I try to be as representative as possible as I put these together because I think it's really important that people are, you know, I really feel like history is being written right now. And because there are so many folks in this country who have proven themselves to be sort of vested in their interests of manipulation and misinformation about the pandemic, it feels that much important to make sure that I'm being as representative as possible as I tell the story of who we are losing. I'll just give you one small example. I'm here in Boston. The newspaper of record here is the Boston Globe. I get the hard copy paper at my door each morning. And on one of the worst days of the pandemic, there was a 12-page obituary section, which, you know, it's makes your heart beat a lot faster. It's terrifying to look through this. And I was really blown away by it as I was looking at it. But the thing about the obituary section is that, first of all, obituaries cost money, right? It's a couple hundred dollars to post an obituary. You have to have sort of the wherewithal and the ability to write that up and the time to produce that. And if you looked through that 12-page obituary section, out of 12 pages, you probably only saw one or two black or brown faces. And yet we know that this pandemic is disproportionately impacting black and brown communities at a rate 2 to 3 times higher than others. And so I think to really get the totality of what's going on, you know, I sort of feel an obligation to go as deep as I can in my research to, you know, pull out stories as long as they're vetted and confirmed sources. And I feel confident that it's accurate, trying to share as many of those as possible from as many different places as possible.
That's really great to hear because I could definitely see a situation where somebody created this account and didn't take it as seriously as you, right? Where it could be victim of like hoaxes or things like that. So it's nice that you're taking the vetting process really seriously. I'm curious about the fact that at the time we are recording this episode, there's been over 258,000 deaths from coronavirus in the United States since the beginning. And as the number is incomprehensible in terms of the destruction and death, right? Like just hard to wrap your head around that level of death. And I'm curious, like, as you conceive of your work, you said you're trying to kind of present a representative sample. Is that kind of where your head's at? Or like, are you trying to like get to every single person that died? Like where do you see your mission overall as you think about the totality of what's happened?
Yeah, it's really been a bit of a moving target, if I'm being totally honest. I mean, when I started this, it was post as many stories as I could in as little time as possible to try to scare people into realizing what the hell was going on and how bad this was, right? Then I realized, first of all, I realized that the Twitter algorithm does not like it when you sort of flood the zone with content. And so I started to really space things out and found that they were getting a lot more engagement, a lot more growth on the account itself. And then it really became a matter of, I want to get as many people to see this as possible so that it can be impactful. And I think now it's reached a scale where I want to be as thoughtful as I can about the storytelling and which stories are appearing, because I want to, you know, sometimes, like, for example, it's important to make sure that, like, there are, when stories of young people who are impacted and who die of COVID, appear, I want to get those into the feed because I need to dispel some of these lies about who this impacts and who it doesn't. Same goes for some of the other sort of demographic issues that I laid out before. I also find that, you know, people, sometimes these things resonate more when they're tied to, you know, certain events and things like that. And so on Memorial Day and on Veterans Day, focusing on, you know, folks who died of COVID, who served, you know, it starts to speak to sort of what people are, the mood of the country at various moments. And, you know, there are so many people that there's a story that fits with all of these moments, right? Like, you know, on Thanksgiving, all these families who are experiencing empty chairs at their table. And they're going to be, we're probably going to get more submissions, I would expect, over that couple, these next couple of days than we've gotten, leading up to this, because so many people are thinking about that right now. And so, I think the long-term goal, look, as you just pointed out, there's been 258,000 people who have died. We've told 3,500 stories. So we're at a little bit more than 1% of those. And I don't think I have any, I'm not deluded enough to think that I'll be able to tell all 258,000, or by the end of this, who knows, 400,000, wherever we end up landing. But I do think that through the sort of approach I've been taking, which is to be very uniform and not do much editorializing from the account, but just tell people who these people were, that over time we can give a pretty full view of how many different types of people this impacted. And I also think that, down the road, I have aspirations that we could use this as an opportunity to go back and look at the stories that never got told, the stories that weren't in the obituaries and weren't in the newspapers, and maybe identify ways to work with, you know, freelance reporters and things like that to be able to subsidize their effort to do some reporting for families that didn't have that option. And so that's more of a down the road question. But, you know, can I tell you something that I feel like sort of crazy, but it sort of speaks to how our federal government has not taken this seriously. I never set out to do this, but the database that I have, because we track every single story that we post, is probably the biggest database of names in this country right now, all in one place. I don't know any other place where you could find 3,500 names of people who died of COVID. And so I feel some responsibility to the archiving of this moment as well. And I've, you know, have talked to some academic partners about what that might look like sort of after the fact. But right now there's still so much urgency for people to make better decisions now that it's sort of secondary to what we're doing at the moment.
Yeah, it has been humbling to see that some of our best sources of information about COVID come from volunteers. Another example, I believe, is the COVID Tracking Project. You may be familiar with them.
Yeah, The Atlantic. They've done unbelievable work. Yeah.
Incredible. And but it is the result of basically a complete abdication of responsibility by the federal government. Right?
100%. So, I mean, the fact that that is in the CDC dashboard is insanity, right? Like, it should not be reliant on The Atlantic to be our sole source of knowing how many people get sick each day. But yeah, here we are.
Nor should the task of memorializing the hundreds of thousands lost fall upon Alex Goldstein, CEO of 90 West, who is a busy guy. Right. But we appreciate you lending your time to do things like this. So Alex, can you tell us about something you've learned in the course of this project that has surprised you? You know, like, when you started this, I think you probably had a pretty, as you said, it's changed over time. You probably had a pretty clear idea of like, hey, I'm going to post this thing to kind of remind people this thing is dangerous, to correct misconceptions. Is there anything you've learned that surprised you as you've gone through this and started memorializing these people who have passed?
Yeah, so one thing that has definitely surprised me, especially in the last month and a half or so, is, you know, look, I consider myself a reasonably modest person. I didn't set out to do something that was going to get a ton of followers. I did it initially because I felt like I needed it, right? But, you know, and it's sometimes when I have had these conversations lately, I kind of can't believe what I'm hearing. But, you know, when I talk to families and, you know, when families submit something, I'm in direct communication with them because I'm always emailing them and sending them the link for their story once it's up and so that they can share it and, you know, whatever else they'd like to do with it. And I've been sort of overwhelmed by the extent to which families feel like this is a really big deal for them. And the reason for that, I think, is about what we were talking about before, which is if you are a family who buried somebody who you love at a funeral with three or four people, and you couldn't hold a service and you went home and then you spent the next 2, 3, 4 months of a pandemic alone in your house coping with that grief, the experience of seeing 150, 200 strangers in the replies of these stories with lots of love and kindness and grace and compassion is a little bit overwhelming. And I've been sort of amazed at how, you know, their response has been like, oh my God, this is really what I needed. And I think it speaks to how isolated we are, because we're talking about a Twitter account here, right? Like, these folks are really feeling like a tweet is a really important thing to them. And it's not because I think I've created something so extraordinary. I think it actually is the opposite. I think it speaks to how little else there is for these folks to access that kind of collective mourning. And I get emails like all day from families saying, thank you so much for giving us this opportunity. We shared it around with the whole family. It was really made our day better. And, you know, so that obviously is really powerful to experience. The other thing that's really surprised me is that most of the toxic trolling, insane behavior that I've become accustomed to on my personal Twitter feed over the last 5 or 6 years has like been shockingly absent from the Faces of COVID feed. And that may just very well be because they haven't found us yet or nobody's sicked them on us or whatever. But at least to this point, it has been a pretty quiet sort of sacred space in that way. And I really hope it stays that way. But I don't know what exactly to attribute it to, but that has surprised me.
I'm glad that that's the case. And, you know, despite the degradation of norms that we've seen over the course of the last 4 years, maybe there are some things that people really can't stomach. And that would be one of them might be attacking a fairly neutral Twitter account that is trying to memorialize people who have passed away at no fault of their own. But who knows? Every time I've tried to set a new, like a floor on what people are capable of, I've always been disappointed. So I try not to assume from now on.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sort of holding my breath on this. And, you know, I also try to curate the account in a way that, like I've shared opinions on the account, but I try to, my really hardcore political stuff, I try to not do on that account. I try to save that for my personal account. And on the Faces of COVID feed, I try to make it as accessible as possible so that if you're, look, I'm not going to ask questions of you if you want to share your loved one and if you want to come and mourn with other people. Like, I'm not here to ask you which party you're from or who you voted for in the last election. You know, I want this to be accessible to the people that can benefit from it.
You know, the other thing that strikes me about what you said, and I was very moved listening to you talk about it just now, is this is a lesson I have learned in my time making podcasts and other content for the internet, is like, often when you create something for the internet, it can often mean something that is different to other people than it means to you.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that, like the example for me would be, and again, I'm not trying to compare what we do, you know, like I think this is very valuable and very hard and meaningful work. And so, whereas most of my stuff is like covering pop culture ephemera, you know, I make shows, podcasts about TV shows and films. And I've gotten emails from people saying like, hey, you know, a relative of mine died, and listening to your podcast like really helped to cheer me up during this time. Or, you know, this was one of the hardest years of my life because I had to face, you know, obstacle X, Y, Z. And knowing that I could depend on like this podcast to be there every week was like helpful. And of course, for me, I'm just getting on Skype or Zencast or whatever and messing around with some of my colleagues online. But for them, it takes on a whole different significance. So it's what I'm reminded of as you talk about, like, you didn't anticipate it would be like this, right? You didn't anticipate like a single tweet would like potentially, you know, make a whole family's day because of how they're able to get recognition for some of their lost loved ones. But
right.
Sometimes,
I would say I wouldn't have even had the hubris starting out to think that that's what it could be. Right. You know, it's didn't have that sort of complex where I thought I was going to come in and, you know, make a bunch of mourning families feel better. You know, but to your point, I'm not, you know, my background is in media relations and in PR. And I think there's an argument that I've done some quote unquote creating over the years, but when I'm learning in something like this, which is really truly creating something from the beginning and seeing it through into something that becomes significant, much like, you know, what you're describing with your work, is that when you create space, right, for people to breathe and to be present. And whether it's talking about, you know, films and, you know, culture, or it's talking about death and pandemics, I think that, you know, we're giving people oxygen, right? Is like giving people a space where they can come and deal with the stuff that's weighing on them is important. And I kind of learned that in this process. I think I have a better respect now for other creators and for what they do to create that space.
Can you share one or two stories that have really stuck out to you, made an impact in your own emotional life?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of amazing. First of all, I've always been known for having a really, really good memory. And so I feel like I've committed a lot of these names to memories, even without without sort of setting out to do that. I had an interesting experience the other day. A woman reached out to me and said that she had lost her dad and to COVID, and she was not familiar with Faces of COVID at the time. When she was having a really dark night a couple weeks later, she plugged her dad's name into Google, and up popped a tweet about him. This was something we had found from an obituary and had just put it out there. And she said it at that moment, it was like this really, really powerful thing. And she didn't even know that we had existed. And so I said, "What was your dad's name?" And as soon as she told me, I could immediately remember his story. He was, you know, from Minnesota, just, you know, kind of like to hunt and fish, you know, like his name meant something to me. Right. And there's a lot of stories like that for me. I think about the ones that stay with me the most sort of fall into a couple different categories. I, you know, given my own upbringing and my own family story, it's really, I like swallow really hard with stories of Holocaust survivors who have, you know, manage to survive the unthinkable and then find themselves dying to this pandemic, and also to veterans who fought at D-Day and, you know, Iwo Jima and sacrificed so much to come home and then die in a veteran's home that the VA was supposed to be looking after them and, you know, failed them. There was a gentleman out in Western Massachusetts, not far, about an hour and a half from Boston, who died in his nursing home a couple hours apart from his wife. And he was a Jewish guy named David Cohen who had liberated a concentration camp in Germany and then went on to create this big, beautiful family in Western Massachusetts, and then only to have he and his wife die 3 hours from each other in the nursing home together. You know, I don't know how, it's hard to even wrap your head around those stories. And then the other stories on the flip side of that are, you know, some of the youngest victims of this, because you can't help but feel like they've fallen victim to a lot of lies about who can be impacted by this, and that a lot of those things, you know, have led to some of these consequences. The last thing I'll say, the ones that I oftentimes are the ones I think about the most, I wish it didn't have to be this way, but I feel like I've had this unbelievable reminder of how like beautiful and varied and diverse the American experience is by reading these stories. And I feel horrible that I have to find that out through their death and their departure from this world, because I wish I could do that when they're still here. But having read these stories, there's just like so many amazing stories of people that do extraordinary things all over this country that you've never heard of before. They're not celebrities and they're not household names. There's one story I always come back to. It's a guy in Connecticut who died in, I think he died in May or June. And he was like a hardcore motorcyclist, big Harley guy. The picture, he kind of looked like a tough guy. And in the obituary, it says that his passion was his Harley motorcycle and fixing it and all this stuff, and then gardening and beekeeping. And I'm like, most interesting man on the planet, right? Like the gardening and beekeeping. But that to me, that's the richness of these stories. And I try to pull those out because I think that I try to write a lot of these tweets in a way that a family member could know what was about their loved one without reading the name. And that the way to do that is to pull out what made these people unique. And there's so, so much of that in each of these stories.
You know what, as you share about how diverse life is, it reminds me of this book I read recently called One Day, The Extraordinary Story of an Ordinary 24 Hours in America. Have you heard of this book?
No, but it sounds like something I would absolutely love, because that's like that kind of minutiae is my favorite. So
it is written by Gene Weingarten, the two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize. And he basically took a random day in American history that was they like chose literally like month, day, year out of a hat, and he decided to chronicle every interesting thing that happened that day.
Amazing.
And what he found was extraordinary. It's an extraordinary book. It has extraordinary in the title. So, but I think you'd appreciate it, because it sounds very similar to kind of the phenomenon you're describing.
Yeah, there was a podcast I listened to. I think it might have been Radio Lab, where a gentleman who was from Lebanon, the country, visited every single Lebanon in the United States of America, and then, you know, talked about his experience going to all these tiny little Lebanons all over America. Yeah. And like some of the interactions that he describes are just like, you know, there's so much goodness in those stories. And I feel like somebody asked me the other day, like, how are you not just horribly depressed doing this all the time? You devote 2 or 3 hours a day to reading stories of people who have died. And I say, I actually find myself if it wasn't for the horrific mismanagement of this pandemic, to me, I would feel really optimistic, because what I see are two things. I see amazing stories of the people who live in this country and reminds me that there's still a lot of goodness out there. And I also see some of the most compassionate, kind, and graceful support of these families once we post the stories. And so I'm surrounded by pretty optimistic stuff, if you can sort of make room for it.
What would you say is your greatest difficulty as you proceed with this project? Like, what's your biggest challenge right now?
I think the biggest challenge I run into is sometimes feeling like I'm, you know, spitting in the wind, because I've just been doing this for so many days, and I look out the window and things are probably worse today. I mean, there's 88,000 hospitalizations total in the United States today, which is the 15th consecutive day of breaking records in the United States. And I feel like I just wish this had worked better, you know, and I don't just mean faces of COVID. I just wished that people had realized by 9 months of this how to pull together and stop it. And sometimes it just feels like all I'm doing is like ringing the bell on more and more and more deaths, and nothing's improving. And that can be really hard, because then I go and I mask up and I go to the grocery store or something like that, and I drive through town and I see 25 people sitting at a restaurant with no masks on eating dinner together indoors. And I'm like, well, what's the point? Like, if literally no one's right. going to take this seriously. But then, you know, I hear from the families and I see the response, and I know that there are people for which this is really important and probably has made a difference. And so, you know, I wrestle with that, because I get really, really, really frustrated with sort of the obstinance of people's willingness to kind of see what their part is in this.
Yeah, I mean, I think you created this as kind of a partially to memorialize victims, but partially as a warning to people, right? Partially, like, you wanted this account to create action, to spur on action. And part of you is discouraged, like, that component seems to have failed, you know, in the sense that, like, things aren't better than they were when you started the account, right? But it's nice that basically the account can still serve an extremely valuable and meaningful purpose to many people out there.
Yeah, I guess I also, one other feature that I struggle with is sometimes I feel like I'm in that scene in Independence Day where, like, Jeff Goldblum is the only person who knows that the world is going to end and that the aliens are coming. Right. It's like, I've got the data in front of me and I'm seeing these stories, and I'm like, if only everyone could see this and understand it, then we wouldn't be here. And then you go outside and everyone's acting normal. And it's like, it sometimes makes you feel like you're losing it a little bit.
I think some of us have been living in, like, a parallel universe, you know. Myself and my wife, we are privileged and blessed to not have jobs that require us to go outside, basically, right? To leave the house. We're not essential workers, right? But, you know, we basically don't see anyone. We rarely leave at all. Only leave the house for essential trips. And but there's people out there just living lives like nothing's happened, right?
We've been
living in these kind of parallel universes for months, and it definitely has gotten exhausting after all that time. So I definitely feel you, not as acutely as you, because you're staring this in the face every day. But I definitely feel what you're saying to a large extent.
Yeah. And the families, by the way, like, the, you know, I actually tried something new and have been doing a live stream once a week on the Faces of COVID feed. And on Sunday night, I had somebody who had lost her dad join. And I was like, so what do you think about this debate around Thanksgiving? And she's like, it's totally insane to me. Like, I just don't go. Like, what are you talking about? Right? Like, do you want to end up like me without your dad? Can you wait 2 more months, 3 months, 4 months to a vaccination so that you don't have to put people in danger? So anyway, yeah, I mean, my wife and I talk about this sometimes, that, like, I am definitely at the extreme extreme end of this because of how much I'm interfacing with the loss part that I sometimes become less empathetic than I should be with the other struggles that this pandemic has caused, whether it's economic struggles in people's lives or just stress of being isolated or feeling alone. Like, I probably need to be more forgiving than I am. And so it's probably something I need to work on. But
I think you have been talking about expanding the project, doing videos and stuff. So tell us a little bit about how you're thinking about the next steps for the project.
Yeah, so I've done three videos so far with a production team that I work with as a partner in my day job. And part of what I've sought to accomplish there is really to go a little bit beyond the individual stories and try to show people scale and scope. And so those have been focused around vocation thus far. There's been a video that I did on firefighters, which was definitely sort of connecting into that 9/11. Like, what would we have been doing if 45 firefighters from fire departments all over the United States died within 3 weeks of each other in a non-pandemic moment? Somebody would have paid a lot of attention to those firefighters. And so putting them all together in a video with some, you know, not discrete symbolism around that was the first one. The second one was focused on teachers and school staff, which we did right around when the schools got back in session. And then the third one more recently was on healthcare workers. And so my goal is to continue to make those sporadically when I think there's sort of a larger point to make around, you know, that type of scale. That costs money. I've been doing a little crowdfunding on that. That's definitely something in the short term. And I think in the long term, what I mentioned earlier, my two priorities are looking at how to sort of elevate some of the stories that might not get told otherwise, where people sort of lack the resources to tell them, because those people deserve the same dignity that the folks who get a, you know, New York Times obituary are afforded as well. And so that's sort of one priority. And the other is to really think about what to do with this data, you know, with this mass, what's right now just a very large Google spreadsheet of all these names. You know, is there a way to, you know, using some of the best practices from the academic world or elsewhere, do some kind of meaningful archiving effort, even something that maybe I would just pursue after we're past the sort of worst days of the pandemic?
Alex Goldstein is the CEO of 90 West, a strategic communications company, and the creator of Faces of COVID, a Twitter account memorializing COVID victims that has over 125,000 followers. Alex Goldstein, thanks so much for joining me today on Culturally Relevant.
Thank you so much for having me, David. Really appreciate it.
Welcome to Weekly Recommendations. It's the part of the show each week where I recommend something I've been reading, listening to, watching, etc. This week, I want to recommend an article over at theatlantic.com called The Last Children of Down Syndrome. It's written by Sarah Zhang, and it appears in the December 2020 issue of the magazine. And it's an extraordinary piece. It basically details how in Denmark, they have virtually eliminated Down syndrome from the population. And it asks, should they have done that? What is the cost of doing something like that? The thing that is most fascinating to me is how in this modern era in which we have the technology to basically select what kind of children are born, it reframes every decision or lack of decision into a choice. I'm going to quote from the article here. Quote, "The introduction of a choice reshapes the terrain on which we all stand. To opt out of testing is to become someone who chose to opt out. To test and end a pregnancy because of Down syndrome is to become someone who chose not to have a child with a disability. To test and continue the pregnancy after a Down syndrome diagnosis is to become someone who chose to have a child with a disability. Each choice puts you behind one demarcating line or another. There is no neutral ground, except perhaps in hoping that the test comes back negative and you never have to choose what's next. What kind of choice is this if what you hope for is to not have to choose at all?" End quote. It's fascinating the decisions that people now have to make or are forced to make or are forced to have be thought of as making now that we have this technology in our hands. And I think we're just starting to reckon with it. And I think this article is a great step on the way to doing that. It kind of lays out all of these options and all of these decisions and all of these lines of thinking. And it's extraordinary. It's extraordinary. Check it out. It's called The Last Children of Down Syndrome. It's over at theatlantic.com. I also had a chance to ask my guest, Alex Goldstein, what his weekly recommendation was. He had a little bit more of a lighthearted one. Here is what he said.
To go back, so for me, it's going back to either The Sopranos or Curb Your Enthusiasm, and that letting that be the last thing I watch before I go to sleep so that I get to, like, sort of default into my, like, 2006, 2007 me that wasn't worrying about any of these things. So that really awesome old TV has done a world of good for me.
That's it for Culturally Relevant this week. Thanks so much for listening. Again, if you are a supporter of the show, head on over to patreon.com/DaveChan, kick in a few bucks that way, or leave a review on Apple Podcasts or follow this podcast on Twitter at CrevShow, CrevShow. This podcast was edited and produced by me, David Chen, and it was powered by Simplecast. Check out Simplecast.com for a great podcast management and analytics solution. I hope you're staying safe out there, listeners. Thanks for listening. And we'll see you next week.